Hello, welcome to The Rest is History and the second of our two festive episodes. Dominic, in the first episode, it was all the Christmas Carol. But for this second one, as a top historian of modern Britain, you would confirm, would you not, that it is very much a tradition that popular formats, when it comes to Christmas, kind of put a bit of holly on, a bit of sprinkling of snow, and give it a festive spin.
They do. They might go to Marbella for a Christmas special.
Exactly, that kind of thing, or Florida, or something like that. But we're not going to do that, because one of the popular formats that we've had this year is top tens. So we've had top 10 eunuchs, we've had top 10 mistresses, we've had all kinds of things like that. But I think it would be fair to say that probably the most popular episode that we did with that top 10 format was with Rachel Morley, who runs the charity Friends of Friendless Churches, and she did the top 10 British churches.
She did. And actually, you know what, Tom? Christmas is about family. It's about, you know, overlooking the slights and snubs that have piled up over the decades. It's about overlooking all the things that divide you and the hatreds and resentments that have festered for so long.
Yep.
And that's why it's nice for me to have my sister-in-law on the programme.
Fan favourite.
Yes. So Rachel, so we can again pretend to bury the hatchet for the next hour. And actually, Rachel's coming to us for Christmas Day, aren't you? Rachel, you still plan to come to us for Christmas Day?
I'm coming to you for Christmas Day. I've actually spent the last 10 Christmases with Dominic Sandbrook, so there you go.
Oh, my God. Is that true?
Yeah,
that's a terrifying fact.
I know. Yeah.
We do our own little podcasts on Christmas Day.
Yeah, how exciting. But actually, from our point of view, the excitement of this episode is that, Rachel, we set you the challenge that you had to give us your top 10 British churches in the space of an hour. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say that...
Time management is not on your LinkedIn page.
but it was very, very exciting. And so basically, you've very kindly agreed to come back, and we're going to replay that with your top 10 festive British churches.
Christmas churches. How exciting.
Christmas churches. The churches that have the most kind of festive connotations. And again, we're going to see if we can do it within an hour.
Okay, so let's try. Stop talking. Let's go.
Yeah, we've had it, haven't we? Yeah, enough flam. Let's get on.
Well, whoa. I thought of something, actually. We should just say Christmas is a time of giving, Tom. And if there's a charity that you would like to give to this Christmas, apart from just Stonehenge and your hedgehogs and all that stuff, which charity will you be donating to?
Well, I've already mentioned it. Friends of Friendless Churches.
Yes. Don't donate to rival church charities. Donate to the Friends of Friendless Churches. Yes. Okay, promotion over. Rachel, go.
Okay, great. Fine. So it is my top 10 Christmas churches. I would probably say top tenuous Christmas churches. So kind of
tenuous.
Tenuous.
Yeah, that's very good.
It's supposed to be a joke. Come on.
That's top quality.
Great, thanks. Fine. Anyway, okay, I'll get straight into it. So the first thing is, let's face it. So at Christmas time, that is when most people go to church, right? I mean, really, even the statistics tell us that. And it's mainly all about candles and singing and all of that. The music is, you know, it's dark and light. It's the wonder and the awe and the kind of somber and joyousness of it all. It's the birth of our Saviour. But as you're out there and you're singing along to Handel or Haydn, I think it's important to remember that these men themselves weren't, they weren't saints themselves. So Haydn, as example, he wrote masses for Advent. He was expelled from St. Stephen's Church Choir in Vienna for cutting off the pigtails of the other choristers.
That's bad.
It is pretty bad. Yeah. It gets worse. In between his temper tantrums, Handel hid in dark wardrobes and quaffed champagne. he did. In the early 20th century, Peter Warlock, I've just broken my pen, Peter Warlock, who wrote Bethlehem Down, he was famous for kind of these notorious carouses. And one thing he liked to do in particular was disturb the local Baptist chapel by driving around outside naked on his motorbike.
Oh my God.
But
was that out of sort of sectarianism? He didn't like Baptists?
Or maybe he just liked being naked on a motorbike. I don't know. And
it just quite cold though at Christmas, wouldn't it?
Very cold.
Anyway, I don't know. But
if you
have
an accident, it's a hard one to explain to the emergency services.
Yeah, exactly. But for me, best of all, is Thomas Weelkes. He was the director of music at Chichester Cathedral in the 17th century. And even if we don't know it, we regularly perform his music at Christmas. It's kind of a routine sort of thing. So Hosanna, Son of David, Hark All Ye Lovely Angels Above, all this sort of thing. This was all his music. But in the 17th century at Chichester Cathedral, he was fined for urinating on the dean from the organ loft. And
at Christmas.
At Christmas. And constantly, loudly blaspheming during the services. So,
goodness.
Number one, wow. Music at Christmas, Thomas Weeks, Chichester Cathedral. So,
I think that's a Christmas tradition that should be revived, don't you, Tom?
But I think it's funny. He was only fined for it. He didn't even lose his job.
You know, what would he have had to do to...
have lost his job, I know. I should say that... that anecdote is particularly came from my friend Robert Bushakiewicz, who is a composer in Toronto. So thank you to Robert for that.
That's a great anecdote. And he was allowed to carry on composing, was he?
Yeah, he was asked. Yeah, no problem at all.
Why did he do it? That's the question. Why?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, the blaspheming does seem weird when you're writing Christmas carols. So he's not like an atheist or something, or a you know. What is he drunk? Is he? What's the motive?
Yeah, I'd say probably a drunk.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay. Yeah, you know. Well, that's also very festive, isn't it?
Yeah,
exactly.
Getting drunk and urinating over congregation.
On top of your part of the, that's yeah. Lovely, yeah.
It's all part of the festive tapestry.
Yeah, exactly.
You've just had your Christmas lunch. You didn't do that at the Friends of Friendless Church's lunch, did you?
I did not do that at the Friendless Church's Christmas lunch, no. Although we did have some nice wine, which was good.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
That's good to know.
Great. Yep. Anyway,
so that was the first one. Wow.
Number one.
That was ridiculously fast by your standards.
I know. But there are some long ones. So I thought I opened it by being, you know, light and dark, you
concise.
Know, somber and joy. So there's long and short. Anyway, there we go. The next one's long. Right. Okay. You opened all of this by talking about giving. Christmas is all about, you know, giving and donating to charity and all. And churches are absolutely about that. So they're, you know, benefaction boards. They hang in churches all across the country. In life and death, people wanted to donate to their local church, to their local school, the almshouse, or most commonly towards the poor. And, you know, I could be cynical and say that their motives were to guarantee them a place in heaven afterwards, but maybe that's a bit mean and maybe they were just very nice, generous people, but, you know, maybe not. Anyway, but some of these boards make specific reference to Christmas. So one example that I really love is at Holy Trinity Blatherwick in Northamptonshire. And here, Mr. Thomas Coles, who died in the year 1684, he left a sum of money, which was forever to buy a plum pudding for the oldest poor men in the parish on Christmas
Day.
Yeah.
That is...
Isn't that nice?
That is. That's kind of Scrooge-esque.
It is. Lovely.
And do they still do that?
No.
Oh.
That's one of the things, because like forever is a pretty like loose term, I think. But equally, yep. Another Christmas one, which is not far from you, Dominic, in South Lee in Oxfordshire.
I know
South
it.
You don't at all. Don't be funny.
I've seen it on road signs.
I don't know
the church. I mean, right. Of course I don't know the church.
Anyway, there's a lovely church there called St. James's. Lovely place. But in there, there's a benefaction board in the North Isle. And in it, again, in the 17th century, John Hart left £50 intended for it to gather interest to buy coats at Christmas for the parish poor forever. Again.
That's nice. I was taught by a man called John Hart, who was the first ever mastermind winner.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah, there you go.
That's good. Rachel, do we know, is this bequest still going? Or has that been cancelled as well?
All cancelled, all over.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I think, there's. It's interesting because a lot of these, so anyway, a lot of these things, they do say forever. And
how can the church get out of that, though? I mean,
well, the money just runs out, you know?
Right.
Yeah, bad investments.
Yeah,
bad investments. Invested in the South Sea bubble or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Northern Rock.
So while, you know, the plum pudding and the coats at Christmas, those sorts of things were all, you know, those are all lovely. Some of the charity was conditional. So one of the churches that we look after is St. Eliu's Llanelu in Powys. In the Black Mountains. Stop laughing, Dominic. And in 1773, Walter Watkins left 10 shillings to be given to two of the poorest children in the parish yearly and forever. But there was one condition. They could only be lawfully begot.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So
well, is that a problem in Wales, Rach? What are you trying to say?
No, I'm not saying that it's a problem in Wales, Dominic. I'm saying that, you know, it was conditional. He didn't care whether they're, you know, they're
that's harsh
they
though, isn't
poor.
It? Because it arguably the illegally unlawfully begot would require
correct. Yes, exactly. Anyway, But the tradition of giving in churches is more than just all those individuals that are memorialised on these benefaction boards. And most churches had poor boxes or alms boxes, and most of them were inscribed urging passers-by to remember the poor. And really, for centuries, these poor boxes were society's main source of poor relief. So two of the earliest poor boxes in England date from the mid-14th century, and they're still found on Holy Island in Northumberland. But most of the surviving ones, which are still in use, date from the 17th century. So from here, this is where the Christmassy bit comes in again. So Boxing Day, it's been a tradition in the UK for centuries. And though it only officially got that name in the 1830s, and it didn't become a bank holiday until the 1870s, it is celebrated on 26th of December, feast day of St. Stephen, and he was an early deacon who was charged with taking care of the poor. That was his thing.
But stoned, didn't he?
Huh?
Stoned to death.
He did,
first Christian martyr.
Exactly. But the 26th of that's fine. The 26th of December was the day that the rich boxed up these gifts for the poor of the parish, and it was also a day off for servants when they received a gift box for their Christmas gift box from their employers, and in turn they would meet their families and they would exchange boxes. So it was like, you know, Christmas Boxing Day thing. But churches played a really important role in this Boxing Day tradition. So coins that were collected in these alms boxes throughout the year were held in the box, and it was opened on Christmas Day, and then on the following day, Boxing Day, the money was taken out and distributed to the poor. So isn't that lovely? So some of these alms boxes are really cool, and some of my favourite ones are in Norfolk. And they kind of, I have a thing for donation boxes. I have an Instagram page called Church Donation Boxes, if anybody would like to follow me, where I take pictures of donation boxes in churches. But I really like them. But there are some really interesting ones. And carved is... it's Watton Church in Norfolk, and it's this little guy, and he's got like, it's a little man, and he's carved, and his hair is kind of all like, kind of straight line, streaky down, and he's got a little, you can't see me, he's got a little hand out like this, and you put the coin into his hand, and then it drops down into a little bag and into the core of the money box. And I love that. It's such.
And how old is that?
17th century.
And is he like almost like a little gnome kind of figure, Rach?
No, like he doesn't have a funny hat and beard and stuff like that.
Right. But, you know, he's like a sort of comical figure. Is he, or is he a serious figure?
No, he looks pretty, I mean, he looks really happy and jolly and like with his hand out, like, oh, put a coin in my hand sort of thing.
Right, yeah.
You know, but I love it. And you can see all the wear kind of from where the coin went on his hand, like, you know, where all the paint is sort of chipped and the wood is kind of gnawed and stuff. So I love that. So anyway, donation boxes are really cool. Huge part of Christmas, huge part of Boxing Day. A brilliant one to be found in Watton in Norfolk.
Very good.
So that's number two.
That's number two.
Brilliant. Okay. So we should try and find a photograph of that and put that up.
Yeah. So Rachel, will you tweet us pictures and all that sort of stuff?
I will, sure. Yeah, that's fine. No problem. Okay. Are you ready?
Yep. Number three.
Okay. Number three. As we approach Christmas, I, as and many other people, always think of M.R. James.
Yes.
Very good, Rach. Those I told stories. You to do this.
I know you did, Dominic. You're not supposed to tell people. I would have done it even if you didn't tell me.
That's a lie, Tom.
that is not true. Although I will say that I have to credit my love of M.R. James completely to Dominic, because I'd never heard of him until he started showing me some ghost stories and frightening the life out of me.
He did. So, we took Rachel when she was quite young, Tom, to a play in London called Ghost Stories, my wife and I. And when and it was a surprise, wasn't it, Rach? Mm-hmm. It was like a surprise treat. And we went around the corner and they saw the front of the theatre and it said Ghost Stories. And Rachel's face fell like a stone. It was like the blood drained. Because you're very easily spooked.
I'm very easily spooked.
Were these based on M.R. James?
No.
They were based on...
Because M.R. James, we should say, shouldn't we?
M.R. James. Go on, Tom. Tell us who M.R. James is.
I can tell you.
All right. Yeah, you're the guest.
I'm the guest. Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks. And I've got the notes, so I might as well, you know, use them. M.R. James, he was a dean and provost of King's College, Cambridge. He was a vice chancellor of Cambridge University. And he was one of the most distinguished scholars in the world for his work on manuscripts. And it was kind of late 19th, early 20th century. That's when he was doing all his work. But really, it's for his ghost stories that he's best remembered. And he started writing these ghost stories whilst he was at King's. And after Christmas Eve services at the chapel, he would invite a select group of students, his friends, his colleagues, back to his room to hear one of these ghost stories that he had written. So that is M.R. James.
And they're always about kind of antiquarians who go and uncover strange things in churches and buildings.
Kind of find whistles and things.
Right, and then they unleash a curse, and then there's like a scratching at the door or a figure on the landscape. Or
exactly. So in the collected ghost stories of M.R. James, Daryl Jones has written this introduction, and I think he writes the most succinct kind of summary of James's his style, kind of... really brilliantly. So he says, in a typical M.R. James story, a bachelor don or antiquarian scholar discovers a lost manuscript or artifact which unleashes supernatural forces, causing him to rethink his comfortable assumptions about the nature of reality. That's good.
Very good. Yeah.
It is. So that is basically like, that's the plot of nearly every single M.R. James story. But James himself is sort of this person, because he himself, in the kind of early 1900s, discovered a manuscript fragment that led to extensive excavation at the Abbey ruins in Bury St. Edmunds. And it led to the discovery of 12th century graves of 12th century abbots that had been lost since the dissolution. So he was actually kind of living this life himself, really. He was this bachelor don, you know, antiquarian scholar. He was this person. So he's, you know, a lot of it is kind of autobiographical. My favourite M.R. James story is The Treasure of Amit Thomas. Tom, you don't know it. Dominic, you think it's...
Well, good. I might do. Remind me of it. I'm sure it'll come back.
It's a scholar of medieval history, and he tells a rector this tale of he's searching in an abbey library and he found clues that lead him to the hidden treasure of this disgraced abbot. Basically, he finds a code in the stained glass and it tells him where the treasure is hidden. And it's so cool. Like, I love that. I love that kind of, you know, the deciphering all the codes and stuff like that. But I said at the beginning that, you know, so much of it was autobiographical. So M.R. James actually is this scholar in this story. So he was cataloguing the glass from the German abbey at Steinfeld. And so upon the dissolution of that abbey, a lot of the 16th century glass was brought over to East Anglia, and it's in lots of East Anglian churches, but a huge amount of it went to the chapel at Ashridge House in Hertfordshire. And now a lot of it is in the V&A. But actually, M.R. James was the guy who was cataloguing this glass at Ashridge House. So he was actually working with these fragments. So he was directly inspired by the objects he was working with. M.R. James's last story that he wrote only about 5 months before he died is called A Vignette. He didn't especially rate it, but it's thought to be the most kind of autobiographical of all of his stories. And it's all about a child seeing a spectre or a monster in the garden of a rectory that he lives. And that was at Great Livermere in Suffolk, where he grew up himself. James, he used characters from the gravestones, the names on those gravestones at Great Livermere in many of his stories. So there's Mrs. Mothersoul, she's in the ash tree. There's Mr. Gaudy in Mezzotint. But James himself is buried at the back of St. John's Cemetery in Eton. And I find it so sad, because I think his stories are so popular and so loved, and he's just got this simple little headstone that just gives the date that he was a provost at Cambridge and Eton, nothing about, you know, anything other of his work, and it's lost at the back of the cemetery, completely overgrown, and you really have to like dig your way around.
But that's quite fitting, isn't it?
It is fitting. I was just
kind of, you know, a lost tomb.
I know.
You know, you really have to know what you're looking for.
I know, but anyway, I feel like it's a bit sad that, you know.
Yeah, that is sad.
Okay, so is that number three?
That's number three. Yeah.
Oh my good God, okay. Tom. So.
Okay. Have we? Is the next one a long one?
Yeah.
Let's take a break now. Then
we should take a break then. But then, Rachel, you've got a massive challenge that you've got to get seven in half an hour.
Same Jeopardy as before. It's exactly the same story. Yeah, it is very exciting.
We were being too jovial at the beginning. We should have wasted time.
I don't think the listeners will think it was a waste. I think they'll think it was time well spent.
Now, right. I think that's a fair point, but it's definitely kind of festive Jeopardy. So,
okay, let's get on with the ad.
So we'll get on with the ad. We'll do this very quickly, and then we'll see you back after the break.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are once again in Jeopardy territory. Rachel Morley has seven churches to do in half an hour or so, Rach. So go. We're going to talk less and you're going to talk more. Go.
Okay, great. So Christmas break, it's all about a time for overeating and watching films, right? So there are lots of cult classics that people watch year in, year out. Miracle on 34th Street, It's a Wonderful Life, Home Alone, Die Hard. For the Die Hard fans out there, there's a scene in Heidi Lake Church. which in real life is the Highland Lake Community Church in Denver, Colorado. Oh. Or some people might like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That was a Christmas movie in 1968. If you're a Chitty Chitty Bang Bang fan, you should go to St. James's Burton Lazarus in Leicestershire. That's a very fine Norman church that actually once homed one of England's first leper hospitals in the 12th century. But anyway, in the churchyard, you'll see the Zabrowski family grave. Count Louis Zabrowski died aged 29. He was a racing car driver, and he was the owner of the real-life Chitty Chitty Bang Bang that he built himself and that Ian Fleming wrote his novel on. Both of Lewis's parents were dead by the time he was 16. He was at that point reported to be the fourth richest child in the world.
Fourth richest.
But I have never seen Die Hard, and I've never seen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I have no idea what I'm talking about. So I'm just going to stick to what I do.
That's never stopped us on this podcast.
Yeah, we've never... That never happened.
So, M.R. James, that we've spoken about just before the break, his ghost stories are very much derived on a Victorian tradition. And one of the most beloved Victorian ghost stories is, of course, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Yes, our previous episode.
So, since it was written in 1843, and according to Wikipedia and my pretty unreliable counting efforts, there have been 25 film versions, 30 cartoon versions, and 22 TV shows, as well as loads of audio and radio versions. So I think it's probably like one of the most adapted
things. And a mime
things.
Version.
Yeah.
A Marcel mime. Marceau.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That sounds terrible though, doesn't it? I mean, that sounds rubbish.
His body is his tool.
Thanks for that.
Welcome.
But for one of like the most kind of enduring, popular and adapted stories kind of, you know, of the last 150 whatever years, 160 years, it actually took Dickens just 6 weeks to write the story, which is about double the time it takes Dominic to write an Adventure in Time book.
Ah, very good. Wow. It's good publicity. Good publicity again. So they're available from all good booksellers, and it's not too late to get your Christmas shopping in.
So anyway, it took 6 weeks for him to write, and he really had such high hopes for it, but it didn't start off too well. Of the first 6,000 copies, he only made a profit of £137, whereas he had hoped to make a profit of about 1,000. And that was because the printing and binding was really expensive, but also there were pirate copies being sold for just 2p. Claire Tomalin, in her excellent Charles Dickens biography, has loads of information about all of this, and I would absolutely recommend Claire Tomalin biography on absolutely anything. Thomas Hardy, Samuel Pepys, everybody. She writes brilliant books. But all of that said, after a slow start, it did take off. And, you know, as I said, it's arguably the best known and most popular Dickens story. In its first 100 years, it sold 2 million copies in the US alone. Dickens took it on tour in England, and he wrote and performed all of these extended sections with different kind of, you know, drawing out different characters and their stories. People queued, and thousands were regularly disappointed because they couldn't get in or they couldn't get tickets. But Dickens sets his story in London, like he told us all about yesterday, so I'm kind of probably going to be repeating some of the things that you've said. But some of the churches and the churchy locations, such as St. Paul's Cathedral, are clearly identified, and we know where they are and what they are. But for others, I've consulted the website London Walking Tours. Mm-hmm. And they convincingly argue that the ancient tower of a church with the gruff old bell that was always peeping slyly down on Scrooge out of a Gothic window in the wall is St. Michael's Cornhill.
That's what we said, Tom.
That's what we said.
Rachel agrees with us.
Yes.
Okay, brilliant. Great.
Did we consult the same website? I think we probably did.
Probably. If you Googled Dickens locations,
we would never do that. I mean, really? I was at the Bodleian Library.
Yeah, fine. So London is all well and good, but I'd like to give the final word and the final church, number four, to my beloved Shrewsbury.
They filmed A Christmas Carol in Shrewsbury in the 1980s.
1984, to be precise, Dominic.
I answered an advert in their local paper, the British North Journal, to appear as an urchin, but they didn't select me.
Dominic, your acting career.
They didn't select me. It's that whole Paddington story all over again, Tom.
So you could have played Paddington, and you could have played a Victorian urchin.
Yeah, I probably would have been like Scrooge or something, but I missed out.
You're too well-fed to really be a Victorian urchin.
Oh, thanks, Rach. Thanks.
Sorry.
You could be a Victorian philanthropist, though.
Yeah,
I could. Yeah. I could have been Mr. Fezziwig. I'd have been Mr. Fezziwig.
Or, Mr. Watermelon, the fella from the Muppets version. Watermelon? Melon? Honeydew. Honeydew. Mr. Watermelon. Sorry, Honeydew.
That would make me Beaker.
It would. That's actually very apt.
It is, actually. Oh, God. Anyway.
Terrifying thought.
Number four. 1984, A Christmas Carol was filmed in Shrewsbury. There's loads of CGI, so they put in like St. Paul's and all of the London landmarks to kind of make it look like London. But there's one prop that remains in Shrewsbury in a churchyard to this day from that film. So it's been there for like nearly 40 years. And that is in the churchyard of St. Chad's, which is, it's the new St. Chad's. So there's the old St. Chad's, which is a bit old and ruined and it's a bit sad, but it's having repairs at the moment. But if you go to the new St. Chad's, it's round and it's got a lovely dome and it's, you know, a lovely Georgian church. But if you scrabble around in the undergrowth there, you'll see a huge slab of limestone inscribed with the words Ebenezer Scrooge. And it's still there.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and they never removed it. So, yeah, it's still there. So, yeah. Floria Fallopia.
No, that's it. That's a brilliant number four.
Okay, yeah. Great. Christmas baking. I love baking. I love Christmas baking. I love baking full stop. Dominic has a something that he describes my baking as never knowingly underbaked.
There is some truth. But Rachel makes very, very good cakes, Tom. She's made a lot of birthday cakes that have occasioned comment from other parents who who's your professional cake maker?
Yeah.
By the Death Star. Rachel made a whole Death Star spherical.
Because it's just been Arthur's birthday.
Yeah. Arthur's birthday. The Hogwarts.
Hogwarts. Anyway, that's all fine. So one thing that I use in all of my baking, not all of it, but most of it, would be self-raising flour. So does anybody know about the history of self-raising flour?
No. Tom, you must know all about this.
You call yourself historians. Anyway, the next time you open your kitchen cupboard, spare a thought for Henry Jones. So Henry Jones was born in 1812 in Monmouthshire, and he was he went on to Bristol to make his fortune. And he kind of crossed over the Severn Estuary into the metropolis of the West, and he set up a business in Broadmead in Bristol. And he was basically a baker, and he was very innovative. And in 1845, when he was 33 years old, he invented something that made his fortune and just kind of changed the baking world forever.
Forever.
He basically invented self-raising flour.
Okay, that's good.
It is really good. And he obtained a patent for it, and Henry Jones Bristol was, you know, all great, blah, 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 blah. He was appointed purveyor of the patent flour and biscuits to Queen Victoria. And basically, what was very interesting, I think, is that the armed forces of the crown were really slow to take up. They could have used his flour for all of their things, but they were really slow to take up. They were very distrustful of it. And it wasn't until...
Was that the fault of Dominic, the useless...
Duke of Cambridge,
who was the most incompetent person that we saw in our
statues.
Our statues walk.
And you were really keen that he continued to stand as a symbol of incompetence, yes. Sort of inspiration to people.
Yes, and so he missed out on self-raising flour.
But hold on, why would the... What military purpose does self...
No, like for the food,
biscuits.
They can throw it in the faces of the French.
No. Biscuits and weevils.
I'm joking. Go on,
yeah,
Rach.
Yeah, fine. So, you know, the kind of biscuits and the kind of the staple of the Royal Navy, they could have had nice biscuits, basically, but they didn't. Until Florence Nightingale herself intervened during the Crimean War. And basically she got self-raising flour used by the army for their biscuits.
So she's got one over Mary Seacole at last on flour.
Yeah, she has. But anyway, basically, this is a quick one. Henry Jones, self-raising flour. He was born in Monmouthshire in Wales. He got married in a church, which is a Friends of Friends Church's church. It's St. Michael's and All Angels, Llanfihangel Rogat.
Oh, say that again.
Dominic. It's Llanfihangel Rogat.
Very good. No, I just wanted to hear it. I thought it was really nice.
Right. Actually, it is absolutely beautiful. Llanfihangel Rogat actually translates as the Church of St. Michael in the Valley of the Roe Deer. And it's so beautiful.
That's a beautiful name.
Isn't that lovely?
It is a beautiful name.
Very nice.
Anyway, that's Henry Jones. He got married in in that church at Llanfihangel Rogat. And he's buried in St. Mary's Caldecott churchyard, not nearby. But his invention lives on and is used every single day by bakers all across the world.
Okay, so that's four. Is that five?
That's five.
So we're halfway there. We're halfway through.
Yeah, we're nearly there. Great. Way up north, where the air gets cold, there's a tale about Christmas that we've all been told. That's the Beach Boys. And they're singing about little Saint Nick. So Saint Nicholas was a 4th century Turkish bishop, and he became the patron saint of children after he gave 3 bags of gold as a dowry to save 3 sisters from prostitution, and he revived three murdered boys that had been pickled in brine, and he had loads of other miracles, including the miracle of the cup. I don't really know if we have time to be talking about the miracle of the cup, but anyway.
Can you describe it in a sentence?
A long sentence that has no
I'm amazed to hear that.
Okay. A rich man prays at St. Nick's tomb and says if he gives him a son, he'll donate a golden cup to the tomb. I don't really know why the dead saint wants a cup, but anyway. The rich man gets the son and he thinks he can be clever and give a fake gold top cup to St. Nicholas's tomb and keep the real gold one for himself. The rich man sends his son to the river with the cup to get some water. The son falls in and disappears and or drowns. We don't know. The rich man is distraught. Then he goes to the tomb with his fake cup and prays and is all weepy. And then a hand appears out of nowhere. It throws the fake cup back at the man. It knocks him over. And then the dead Orloff's son appears and says, St. Nicholas saved him, and hand over the gold cup to the tomb and you'll get your son back. They do, and everybody lives happily ever after. Anyway. The cycles of St. Nicholas's miracles are found in medieval wall paintings in loads of churches, like St. Mary Aldermaston in Berkshire, Haddon Hall Chapel in Derbyshire, All Saints Inworth in Essex. But I think my favourite depiction has to go to the St. Nicholas's miracles carved onto the 12th century font at Winchester Cathedral. And it's a Tournai marble font, so Belgian, not real marble, polished black limestone. But on that you have the miracles of the, you know, reviving the drowned boys, the miracle of the golden cup, the miracle of the girl, the prostitution gold dowry things. And it's beautifully polished and it's just divine. And there are only 7 Tournai marble fonts in the whole of England, and 4 of them are in Hampshire. And this one at Winchester Cathedral is just beautifully carved, you know, so distinct. 10 out of 10.
I'm amazed they don't make more of it, bearing in mind the popularity of Father Christmas.
Yeah. Well, talking about Father Christmas, I was actually, whilst I was reading about this, I kind of went down a bit of a rabbit hole and wondered why Santa Claus was called Santa Claus. Do you know this?
It's American, isn't it? It's because of its melding of traditions in America, isn't
it? Yeah, St. Nicholas.
Oh, okay, fine.
Is that what it is, Rach?
Yeah, it's 18th century Dutch families that went to America. So St. Nicholas in Dutch is Sint Niklaas. That was shortened to Sinterklaas. And then that eventually became Santa Claus.
I'm very fanatical against Santa Claus. I'm very much a Father Christmas
man. You're a Father Christmas man, aren't you?
Are you really?
We talked about this last year in our previous Christmas special.
Yeah. Okay. You never hear the word Santa Claus pass my lips, Rach. Never.
You would never. And actually, if anybody else says Santa Claus, you always kind of admonish them, don't you?
I'm a nice person that way.
I know.
Curling of the lip.
Yeah, exactly.
A sneer of cold command.
No, Tom, it's not even like that. He'll say, Santa Claus? Who's Santa Claus? Yeah. Who are you talking about? Do you mean Father Christmas? That's what he would say.
He'll take back the sixpence that he'd just given to her. The shoeless chimney sweep.
This is a terrible insight into Christmas in the Sambrook household.
I know. Yes. It is. It absolutely is.
But it's so good that Rachel comes every year. So draw your own conclusions.
And I would say that Dominic is one of the best people to spend Christmas with, I would say.
That is so touching to hear.
So much fun. So much fun.
The jollity of Christmas.
I'll be coming
Fezziwig
for the next 10 years.
Playing Sir Roger de Coverley.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay, let's go on. That was number 6, Winchester Cathedral, Tournai Marble Font, St. Nicholas, great. Okay, next up is number 7. So there's loads of talk this year, again, like last year, about Christmas being cancelled, second year in a row. Everyone's very sad about it. But actually in Scotland, Christmas was cancelled for about 400 years. Now, Tom, do you know this? You know it, do you, Tom?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it only became a holiday in the 60s.
Yeah, Dominic didn't know this at all. I traded out on him last week.
Yeah, I didn't know it. I didn't know it. I don't know. I still don't. Tell me, Rich.
I will tell you, Dominic. So in 1583, there was a decree made at St. Mungo's Cathedral, which is Glasgow Cathedral. That is number 7. Just so you know, just so there's no doubt. So the Glasgow Kirk rejected a calendar defined by mysterious superstitious times.
Popery.
Exactly. And they ordered the excommunication of those who celebrated Christmas or Yule. And even singing a Christmas carol was considered a serious crime. Eventually, in 1640, an Act of Parliament in Scotland made the celebration of Christmas illegal. And even just baking a Christmas bread was a criminal act.
Wow, that's harsh.
It is harsh. The ban was officially repealed in 1712, but the church continued to frown upon any festive celebrations, and the punishments were harsh, and there was no public holiday for Christmas people on Christmas Day. So it wasn't until 1958, so the 25th of December, 25th of December became a public holiday in Scotland. Boxing Day, which we've already talked about in church number two, only became a public holiday in 1974. So because Christmas was cancelled, the Scots made a much bigger deal of New Year's Eve or Hogmanay. So,
That's why they make such a big deal of it. I didn't know that. Yeah. That is interesting. Yeah. So what were they doing in sort of the early 1950s, while people in England and indeed the rest of the world were celebrating Christmas? Are people genuinely going to work in Scotland? Really?
I think so, yeah.
Scottish listeners.
Tell us.
Yeah, tell
us. What were you doing in 1950s, Christmas 1957?
Yeah, exactly.
We want to know. But Scotland wasn't the only place that had to cancel Christmas. So in 17th century England, it was thought that Christmas, again, was far too much fun. It wasn't treated with the solemnity that it deserved. So in 1647, the Long Parliament said that Christmas should no longer be recognised, and that led to general unrest. And in Canterbury, there was a woman thrown in prison for baking a Christmas pudding. And shopkeepers were imprisoned for not opening their shops on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And Father Christmas was banned, wasn't he?
There
was a cartoon of Father Christmas being sent packing.
Wrongly attributed all this to Oliver Cromwell, but he, of course, was not running the country at that point.
Your big hero, yeah.
Yep. Everyone knows that.
Okay. I'm making very good time. I'm very
pleased. So St. Mungo's was the church?
Number seven, yeah.
Yeah.
Because people were complaining the last time that I didn't have an active Scottish church in my list. So you've got an active Scottish cathedral now. So
yeah,
happy Christmas. okay, so the next one. At this time of the year, lots of people will be getting new kind of diaries or calendars in their Christmas stockings on Christmas morning. Or if you don't get one in your stocking, you might get a free one from your local Chinese, if you're lucky. but there's a church in Kent that has the coolest and the most difficult to read calendar etched into one of its walls. So this church, church number 8, is St. Mary's Eastry, and this is calendars. So this is really hard for me to try to explain. I'm going to do my absolute best. But there's one pillar, and it's carved, it was carved in the 1320s, and it's got this Dominical dial carved into it. Tom, you might know about it. Dominic, you won't know anything.
I don't.
I think it's unique in English churches. If it's not unique, it's absolutely very, very rare. So it's called a Dominical dial or a Sunday letter dial. And what it involves is it's four concentric circles, and they're divided into 28 equal parts, and that depicts the 28 years of the solar cycle. And the 28 parts carry really deeply cut Lombardic letters A to G, and they each appear 28, each letter appears four times in the 28 segments. And then in the next outer ring, each letter appears once, and the double lettering is allowed to allow for leap years.
You know who'd like this? It's Seb Falk, who did medieval science.
Yeah.
Medieval science.
He'd love a medieval calendar.
Well, the thing is, I'm going to try to explain how it works, but I don't really know. So I'm going to,
Right. Perfect. Anyway,
well, should we just say it works? Should we just say it kind of works?
No, Tom, I have things to say.
Okay. Sorry, no.
So what the dial was used for specifically, it was used to calculate the day of Easter in the following year. And from that, then you could calculate the dates of the subsequent festivals and feast days, including Christmas. So I really haven't been able to get my head around how it works. But the letters need to be read in conjunction with the golden numbers. And each letter corresponds to a different number. So A equals 0, G equals 1, F equals 2.
That's a very strange way of ordering it.
I know, exactly.
This is like the worst Christmas game ever. And if you roll a 6.
Yeah. So the Sunday letters are set out in the Book of Common Prayer, tables and rules for movable and immovable feasts. And apparently it will all be good, and the calculations will be good and true until 2099. So that's pretty good going, right?
Yeah.
So, okay. This is how it works. You take whatever year it is, like 2021, you add to that a quarter of that year, then you add the number 6.
Right. You stand on one leg.
Then you divide all of that by 7. And whatever the remainder is, i.e. 0 to 6, that will correspond to a letter on the wall that some That is so brilliant.
And do they do it? Are they?
There must be a simpler way than that.
No, but yeah, like
so, it still works.
Apparently it still works.
God, what fun!
So,
where's this again? Where's this church?
St. Mary's East Street in Kent. So it's a really cool church, and this is a brilliant device. I have no idea how it works.
Tom, you should go. It's not that far.
I'm going to go. Yeah.
Yeah, you should go and try and figure
those
out how
those long
it works.
Winter days will just fly by.
There's like there's a thing that the Kent Archaeological Society have done where they've tried to explain how it works. I haven't. I read okay. it very. Yeah.
Well, there's a challenge for 2022. We'll try and work that out.
Yeah.
So is that number seven?
That's number eight.
Oh, great! So we've got two more to go.
We've got two more in 6 minutes. Fine.
Perfect. You can take your time.
I can. Yeah. Okay. So, picture the scene. It's New Year's Eve, and you're in Camelot. King Arthur and his pals are celebrating the Christmas season. And in comes the mysterious Green Knight who joins in the fun and the games. And he challenges any knight to strike him with an axe. And if in return, he can take a return blow a year and one day. Did you do an episode on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight?
No, we haven't done about it, haven't we, Tom?
Yeah, we might.
Okay, well, maybe you should.
I just saw the film about it last week.
Oh, okay. Very good. So this is the story of Gawain and the Green Knight. So this knight called Sir Gawain, he accepts the Green Knight's challenge, and he strikes his axe and he actually beheads the knight. But the Green Knight just stands up, picks up his head, sticks it back on. He's absolutely fine. And he reminds Gawain of the appointed time and place that he is going to have his reciprocal blow. So it will be 1 year and one day time. So it will be New Year's Day the following year, and it will be in a place called the Green Chapel.
Right.
So for centuries, scholars have tried to figure out where that Green Chapel is. It's described as only an earthen mound containing a cavern, but most accursed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So there are two places in the Northwest Midlands the scholars think the location of the Green Chapel could be. So the first one, which is church number 9, it's not really a church, but sort of is a church, is Lud's Church. Do you know this?
No.
Okay. No. So Lud's Church is a deep chasm in the Gradbach hillside in Staffordshire. It's created by this massive landslip, and it's this close, damp, overgreen, bright green, mossy kind of chasm in the rock. It's a really good place for a green chapel because it's green. But it's also a place where the Lollards, these proto-Protestant followers of John Wycliffe, met to worship in the 15th century. And it's thought that Lud's Church might be named after Walter de Ludank, who was captured there at one of their meetings. And to me, that kind of dark space kind of evokes the fear and the evil and the cursedness that you'd expect Gawain to
feel in his
Green
Chapel. It's not a chapel now.
No.
It's just a cave.
It's just a cave, but it's called Lud's Church.
Yeah. You could go and pray in it if you wanted, Tom. I mean, no one's going to stop you.
Or sharpen my axe, isn't there? There's kind of whetstone in the poem.
Are you being... Are you being very pedantic, Tom, saying it's not a church? Because I have extra.
No, Rachel, I'm absolutely not. I just wondered whether it was, a kind of groovy green chapel.
It is
groovy green chapel.
It's a groovy,
go for midnight mass or something.
Yeah, Sir Gawain and the groovy green chapel.
Yeah, I just think they're missing a trick there, the Church of England or whoever.
Yeah,
they could.
Rachel has strong views about the Church of England, Tom. We don't want to get into that.
Some church could take it over and make it into a chapel, because Green Knight, it's been this film this year. I'm sure people would love to go there.
Want to take Tom Holland up on his promotional offer, get in touch with him, and Tom Holland's Green Chapel could be open. Like those terrible winter wonderlands that people go to just before Christmas Day, they complain. Queues were massive. Yet another Tom Holland's Green Chapel failure.
The Green Knight, he wasn't a giant. He was, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, no, it's very exciting.
Okay. Anyway, that's Lud's church, right?
And that's your church.
That's number 9. But I just want to stick in there so other people suggest that the location for the Green Chapel could be Nan Tor Cave at Wetton Mill, which is only about 10 miles away. So this is definitely a mound with a cave. It's got multiple entrances into it. But parts of it have kind of collapsed, like the roof has collapsed, it's very overgrown inside, so it's kind of hard to kind of see what it would have looked like in the 14th century.
Quick question for both of you, because you will both know more about this than me. Why do people think it has to be in Staffordshire? Is it because of the dialect of the poem? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, oh, of course, it's not real, is it? I mean, there wasn't really a Green Knight. Well, so it could be, you know, it could be, it could be, it could be either or none of them.
We've covered, yeah, you don't know. Rachel's just done an impersonation that won't mean anything to anybody but me. because we've already covered, you know, talking snakes in this year's podcast with guiding Alexander the Great across the desert. And you don't know that didn't happen.
Yeah. And all of those kinds of things. And indeed Scrooge.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, could have happened.
No, but I'm just pointing that out, that it could be either of them or none.
Okay.
Your final choice,
I have 1 minute.
The final countdown.
No, you can go over. You can go over. We'll cut out all your earlier stuff.
Thanks. anyway, so, okay. I'm worried that this might be a bit of an anti-climax now, but anyway. So, no. Christmas.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so Christmas, it's all about the birth of Christ, okay?
Right? Okay, so, yeah.
Scene
controversial, but yes.
Hard-hitting religious punditry. It's like a sermon by a church of England vicar.
Okay, so scenes from the Nativity, the appearance of the angels of the shepherds, the adoration of the Magi, the Magi's dream, Joseph's dream, the flight into Egypt, the massacre of the innocents, they are daubed onto walls all over England and Wales. So my first big shout-out, because I like to do a church shout-out, is to St. Aileen's, Hanalian in Ross in Denbighshire. Now, this is a really cool church. Everybody should go there. It's got these painted panel ceilings. So it's got the adoration of the Magi. It's got the Magi's dream. But it's got all of these painted medieval painted saints kind of all over the ceiling. Painted onto timber. Absolutely brilliant. I have a song.
Hey,
great. Well, I was wondering if you would have a song.
Well, just because, you know. Anyway, I'll just get straight to it. So the church is St. Aileen's Llanelian. Okay?
Yeah.
And it goes like this. Oh, I'm Clanalian. I'm Clanalian Church. I'm an old church in Denbighshire. Oh, I'm Clanalian. And it goes on like that.
That's amazing. That's brilliant.
That's possibly even better than your Saxon song.
I can't believe it's Christmas Churches 23.
Okay, fine. But if you want to see kind of holy infancy, nativity type scenes on churches, you should definitely go to churches at Ashampstead in Berkshire, Thorn and Parva in Suffolk, Pinvin in Worcestershire, Newington in Kent. And those are all kind of 13th, 14th century paintings. A personal favourite, again, is in Oxfordshire. Dominic, only down the road from you. You haven't been to see it. It's St. Peter's at Vincula, South Newington in Oxfordshire.
Oh, I know South Newington. Yeah,
you drive.
Have you been
past
to the church
it.
Though?
Yeah, I've never been to the church. I've never stopped the car.
Exactly.
You know, the garage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's on the way to Banbury.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this, everybody should stop there because it is an amazing church. Brilliant because you can always get in, which is always a bonus. But in terms of nativity scenes, it's got like a real kind of cartoon strip along the north wall of the arcade in the nave. But what's really great about it is it was painted with oil paints in the 1300s. So the colours are really rich and saturated. So unlike the kind of clay ochre paints that are quite faded everywhere else, I mean, the colours just like pop off the walls. And there's, you know, you've got a lovely little flight into Egypt where you've got Mary on a donkey and stuff like that. But the most famous thing there isn't actually a church, but it is a church. The most famous thing in that church is not a Christmas scene, but it's the martyrdom of Thomas Becket, and it's huge and it's amazing. So
how did that survive?
I suppose they were just all painted.
They just
over.
Whitewashed it. Yeah.
But that is a brilliant church, and definitely you should definitely go there. But my top choice for holy infancy scenes this Christmas would be
so number 10.
So number 10.
The last of the festive list.
The last of the festive list is St. Botolph's Hardham in West Sussex. Now, I did give this a shout out in the last one. Dominic,
I remember.
Stop making a face.
Yeah, I remember you. St. Bothell's is.
It deserves.
I've got something on you, clearly.
No, it deserves more than just a shout out because this is the place that has some of the earliest wall paintings in the UK. They date from about the 1100s. They were painted over in 1300, so they survived because they weren't. Fashion, Dominic. Anyway, okay. So in this little church, kind of cars whiz past, nobody knows it's there, small little whitewashed church. inside in pink and yellow ochre. There are about 15 scenes from the Holy Infancy. You know, I'm not going to list them all, but my favourite is the one of my favourites is the flight into Egypt. You've got Mary on this little gawky donkey. You've got the presentation in the temple where all the urns start toppling, and then you've got the massacre of the innocents. And I mean, I guess what's so brilliant is they're only kind of spectral remains on these walls, but they're even still, they're just so wrought with drama and violence. So these babies are held up by their ankles, ready to be beheaded. And there are bodies kind of strewn around the ground, and it's just so gruesome. But as a nice little fact, one thing is, so the walls are, it's all kind of pink and yellow. Those are the kind of colours that they went for. They would have been kind of more kind of golden and red, I guess, originally. But for kind of things like halos, they used a thing called salt green, which is one of my, one thing that I always mention because I think it's so cool. So the salt green is like almost like a lurid kind of acidic green for the halos and kind of the really important bits. And how they made this salt green was they had sheets of copper, they smothered them with honey, they put salt on top of it, and they dipped it into a vat of urine for a couple of weeks, took it out, scrape it all off, grind it all up, and then you have this lovely bright green paint for kind of all of the most celestial little bits of it. So, yeah. Now, so those are my 10. I have a couple of more things I'd just like to say very quickly.
I do. Yeah.
Okay. So one that would have absolutely made the top 10, but it was in my other top 10, so I couldn't have it, was St. Andrew's Boynton in East Riding of Yorkshire. So this is the one where the guy, William Strickland, went to America and brought back turkeys, and he's got turkeys all over his church.
Yes,
do you remember
course,
that
yes,
one?
Yes,
so, I mean, yeah. That would obviously be in a top 10 of churches, Christmas churches, but it had already been in the other top 10, so... I just want to put it out there. If anybody wants to hear more about that church, please listen to the previous episode. Okay. Yeah. I really wanted to talk about customs like the Mary Lude in Wales and Hoodening, the Hoodening horse in Kent.
What are they?
Those are things basically where you get like, it's in Wales, the Mary Lude is like, it's a horse's skull and it's on a spring and you...
Oh,
like,
yes. And, yes. And it chases people around the street.
Yeah, it's like chasing but singing and kind of jolly, and it's supposed to be good luck, and she comes to your door. People say that it's like derived of the donkey that Mary went into Bethlehem on.
That's in the The Dark is Rising books by Susan Cooper.
Yeah, she's brilliant. Actually, Susan Cooper, she's got one scene in The Dark is Rising.
The Grey King, the green mantle.
No, I can't remember which one. Green cover book, really good. But it's where it's Will. It's when Will is the main character. And he's...
That's the first Dark is Rising, isn't it? It's not Oversea Under Stone.
But actually, there's one scene in that I was going to try and find as a top one of the top churches, because I think it's so frightening, actually, because they're in the church and, you know, it's like all the demons are like bashing on the windows outside the church and they're kind of trapped inside. And they're like trying to...
That's the first, that's number two, The Dark is Rising, I think.
The Dark is Rising.
Yeah.
So, it's so good and it's so scary.
Yeah. That's set in the Chilterns, isn't it? Set in the,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, anyway, but this Mary Lude, the Grey Mare, is a kind of a Welsh thing. But there are loads of other versions of it all throughout England. So there's a Hoodening horse in Kent, which again is where they used like sometimes a wooden head, sometimes a horse's head that was decorated, that kind of went around in the Cotswolds. There's a thing called the Broad where they used a decorated bull's head. In the East Midlands, they used a goat's head and it was called Old Top. So it's kind of an old tradition. And I really wanted to try and...
There's one in Salisbury.
Is there?
Yeah. It used to go around the streets with a giant. It's in the Salisbury Museum.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Because, Tom, I was trying to find a church connection and I couldn't.
But it's not a church. I think they kept it in the Guildhall or something. So it's nothing to do with the church. Yeah. But I'm just throwing it out there. It's very, it's very sinister.
No, well, but this is the thing. So just as a kind of a, you know, I can't, there isn't a Christmas connection to this, but basically there is a really interesting story about three horses' heads being found in the spire of a church in Northumberland in Elston, St. Cuthbert's. Tom, your friend, St. Cuthbert?
Yeah, yeah.
Elston in near Alnwick in Northumberland. And they found these three horses' skulls that were arranged kind of into a triangle in this like cavity, completely sealed cavity in the top of the spire, which is really cool. So like kind of some sort of protective sort of thing. Some people say it's like for like resonance or reverberation of the bells or whatever. But I don't really see how that would work.
No, it's a bit more M.R. James.
Yeah,
very M.R.
Exactly.
James. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was that. I would say, just as a fan of the podcast, the St. Cuthbert's episode, Tom, was one of my favourites.
Oh, thank you.
Great. How could
honestly,
you?
Honestly, do you know, Dominic so didn't you? Want to do that. He didn't
yeah,
want to do that.
I'm shocked at that.
No,
but
I
you're
mean,
right. It was a brilliant decision to do
you prefer that. Have you still not
so
listened
I was
to your
right
own episode?
And Dominic was wrong.
I have not listened.
Rachel refuses to listen to our own episode, Tom, would you
oh, that's...
No, Rachel, I'd be too embarrassed. But just last thing I wanted to say, again, something that I couldn't fit in and I really want to, but for me, this is very important. And I will tell you why. So I love tinsel. I love tinsel. So tinsel was invented in Nuremberg in 1610. And it's derived from this old French word, escintelle, which means to sparkle. I can't speak French. There is a place in Monmouthshire in Wales called Coombe Braun. It's a new town. I think you should do a podcast on new towns if you haven't done one already.
Good subject.
Yeah.
Good subject. So I think you do something on the new towns, but Coombe Braun in Monmouthshire, it's the UK's largest tinsel production factory, and I just love the idea of it. I have to say, yeah. I love tinsel. And at the height of their season, they produce 656. Sorry, I'm doing like a pretty patella. I can't get my numbers out. 656,000 feet. Of sparkly, sparkly stuff. Every at the height.
It's amazing. It was invented in the early 17th century. I would,
yeah.
I would not have known that.
It's probably not very eco-friendly though. Rach, tinsel, is it?
No, it's not.
Yeah.
So basically,
but
in
it's
the
festive.
In the beginning, it was real silver, and it kind of caught the light of the candles and stuff to make it sparkle. Then silver tarnishes, so they started to use a lead, which doesn't tarnish, but lead's not great, you know.
Yeah,
so
not ideal.
Kind of poisons you.
Yeah, it poisons you exactly. Yeah. So then lead went out, and now they use like a sort of PVC thing. So no, it's not great. But I just tinsel makes me happy.
I remember that on Christmas Day. That can be a Christmas present, a big bag of tinsel.
Anyway, but just to say, this place in Coombe Braun in Monmouthshire, they pride themselves, actually kind of in an article, they say, they pride themselves on their pert and bushy products.
Which is
exactly what you want tinsel to be. But
it
also,
is pert and bushy.
Coombe Braun is important to me because it is where the founder of the Friends of Friendless Churches was, where he was born and grew up. So there we go.
What was his name again? Ivor
Bulmer Thomas. Fantastic person. You should do a podcast on him.
Well, that's a reminder to our listeners that for Christmas they should all donate money to the Friends of Friendless Churches to save some of these churches that you have been talking about.
Yeah.
So on that note, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I shall see you at Christmas. Mm-hmm. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful, happy and healthy Christmas. Don't follow Tom Holland down the Scrooge Road, the Bar Humbug Road. But
no,
be like,
follow me down the Scrooge Road because I'll be going out handing turkeys to.
I should be dancing like Mr. Fezziwig.
Yeah.
Or Mr. Fozziwig, of course, as some of us know him from the Muppets Christmas Carol. So
and Dominic, yes, we will actually amazingly be back on Christmas Day.
Now this is very exciting, isn't it, Tom? Shall we tell the listeners about this?
Yeah, you go ahead and tell the listeners.
So Tom had this idea. I told him it's a terrible idea, but he has prevailed. And I think it's a brilliant idea and you're all going to love it, of doing the 12 days of Christmas, of doing a podcast every day for one of the 12 days. So we'll be doing them about events or moments that happened on this day.
And each one of us has chosen.
And each one of us has chosen. Exactly.
So
Tom's are all...
The 26th, 27th, so on.
About eunuchs and genital mutilation.
No, they're not.
The Labour government of the late 70s.
You will have to listen to find out whether that is true or not. But we won't be doing these kind of podcasts until after Twelfth Night. And then in the new year, we'll be back with the customary two episodes a week, or maybe more, depending. But in the meanwhile, have a very, very happy Christmas. Have a great new year. And we will see you in the new year.
Merry Christmas. Goodbye.